welcome to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast. This week, I'm with Patty Gallagher Newberry, who has been on the podcast as our guest host. So welcome back, Patty.
Happy to be with you.
And if you're here, we're talking about something serious.
Oh, usually. Yeah. This one's really serious.
This is serious. So we're going to kind of like break the usual format. Patty and I are going to suspend with the witty repartee and get right into it, because our guest this week is Ayman Solomon, who, if you don't remember, was the former imam chaplain at Children's Hospital, who was here in this country on asylum status from Egypt, and without any warning found himself detained in the Butler County jail, which is also serving part of it as a facility to hold ICE detainees. So, Patty, why don't you kind of set up the conversation we're going to have with Mr. Solomon?
Right. So we didn't know his name before July. On July 9th, his advocates contacted the media that he had been arrested at the ICE facility out in Blue Ash. There was a press conference that afternoon. He was detained, and then we began to learn about his backstory. So he'd come to the United States in 2014 from Egypt. 4 years later, he won asylum status, which gave him the protection to continue living in the United States. And he came here because, he said, he had been persecuted in his home country for his activism, for his speaking out against the Egyptian government, for his work as a journalist, covering the Arab Spring and other kinds of government uprisings. And so that's as much as we knew about him. But, you know, day after day, week after week, we continued to report on his case as we learned more. And it was crazy. There were just so many twists and turns and wrinkles and allegations and disputes of allegations. And then after 72 days in September, he was released with, and it was a giant surprise to him, to his attorneys, to the media. And I went to the press conference on that Friday in September when he had been out of jail just 4 hours.
All right. Well, Ayman Solomon, who has been out now for about a month. This is the first time we've had the opportunity to sit down to talk with him at length to find out a little bit about his experience as a detainee, how he got to that point. And so I think we should just jump right in and bring on our special guest, Ayman Solomon. It is special guest time on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I would like to welcome to our studio today, Ayman Solomon. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll start things off. You have been released from the detention center in Butler County. You were there for more than 70 days. How have things gone since you've been out? How are you doing? How are you feeling? What is it like to be through this ordeal?
My release was unexpected, just like my detention. So I was not really ready to be out and live as a free man again. As I mentioned in multiple occasions, that I almost lost hope of getting out and being free. So I'm slowly adjusting. The first week was very overwhelming. After 73 days of detention and restrictions and control, I'm finally free. So trying to adjust to the new life was difficult. I asked multiple people that met me in the first few days, during the first few days, is that really true? Is that happening? I was really in a kind of denial. And eventually I started adjusting slowly, trying to enjoy the things that I was deprived of during my detention. I stay out late because somebody was telling me when to go to bed in jail. I wake up when I want because somebody used to wake me up at 5:30 a.m. I eat what I want. So slowly adjusting, and I'm also starting seeing a therapist to help me with the trauma that was caused by this long detention.
Let's go back to July 9th, the day that you were first arrested. Can you walk us through what happened that day and how did it all kind of played out?
So we were supposed to have a meeting with an ICE officer, and they told us it was just a regular check-in. After my asylum status got revoked, they said, now you have to appear at an ICE office in order to check in and bring us your passports so we can make sure that you will comply and go to court as planned. And because of the whole situation in the country, you couldn't really believe that it's going to be just a check-in. So I would say I was 50-50. I might go home and it's just a regular check-in, but they also might detain me for reasons that I don't know. I had an attorney with me and some friends wanted to support me. So we had like 15-20 people that came was undivided. This is an organization that is working to support immigrants. So they brought some clergy, mostly clergy, besides some friends. 15-20 people were waiting outside, expecting that I might be detained. And at 9 a.m., we got into the ICE office, and we found two people, two officers, not one. The other one was introduced as an agent from the FBI, which was not planned. We did not get any head up, any notice that we'll be meeting the FBI. So that was disturbing and scary. I know the government accused me of providing material support to a Tier 3 undesignated terrorist organization. And we kept fighting that during our meetings with the USCIS office in Chicago. But now having the FBI made it look like there was, they're either having some information and they came to verify it, or they're probably trying to have a long interview where they could find some discrepancy of anything I've said before so they can use it against me in court. And in both scenarios, this was scary. They asked me if I would answer some questions, and they told me that this is voluntarily, so I don't have to. And they give me a consent to sign. After a few seconds, you know, looking to my attorney, and we were not expecting this, so we did not have something in mind, have a response. But for me, I said, no, I'm gonna speak. If you guys, I've been harassed since 2018, right after I got asylum, and in 2021, I lost my job as a prison chaplain in Oregon because they said there was an FBI flag. Never met any one of them in person. So for me, well, if you have some information that you need to verify, I'm here for that. And he told me that you can withdraw from this conversation. You can leave anytime. You can skip any question. And which was, communicated as a short interview, a few questions, ended up going for 2.5 hours, where they asked me about basically my entire life, my life in Egypt, my political views, my religious views, my acquaintance with any Muslim organizations, including very extreme, violent terrorist organizations, and many that I actually never heard of before. My life in the U.S. The interview went for 2.5 hours. It was mainly with the FBI. Like the ICE officer rarely asked questions. And to be honest, after the first intense few minutes where someone is facing FBI, you know, that came to interview me because of terrorist allegations. It was intense, but eventually I really felt like relaxed. I had nothing to hide. There was nothing in that I believed in or anything I did that I felt ashamed of or afraid of. After getting over the first 10 minutes, I felt like they also got relaxed. Eventually, mid-conversation, the FBI agent became a little bit more friendly, you know, together with the IS officer, and I felt like it was a good idea to talk to them. I answered every question they asked me. I did not actually skip any question. Was transparency, and then at the end of the conversation, we expected them to just let me go. And they asked us to excuse them for 2-3 minutes. They left the room, and 3 minutes after, they came back and said, Mr. Solomon, you are under arrest. You are under arrest. And I was shocked. To be honest, this was shocking. And I felt like, you know, everything became dark. Like right now, I'm going to be detained and I'm going to be deported. And for a minute, I just recalled all my painful, traumatic experience in Egypt, because it seems like these people are serious. They started discussing the revocation of my asylum in December, and I met them in February, and now we are in July. It seems like they're serious about it. After some discussion with them, the ICE officer said, to be completely honest, I don't know why. Like, we just got some order that anyone who comes to the ICE officer office, anyone should be detained. And
when they said you were under arrest, did they have a charge? Did they say why?
They didn't say why. And I would say they were a little bit confused. And I would say also they were, this to me at least, they seemed embarrassed. Because our conversation was very, very transparent. They started even laughing and joking at the end. And many questions, they would ask the question, and they kind of expect my answer. This is not the guy that we're looking for, we're going after. This is what I felt. And at the beginning, he was asking about every detail and trying to go back to my answers to make sure that he heard it right. Eventually, he was just getting over the questions because it seemed like he had some job to be done, but basically, what I felt was he believed that I was the wrong person. So it was they were kind of embarrassed to really even tell me. They were not looking at my eyes when they said you were under arrest. And I asked them why, what did I do wrong? I'm in court, I have a court hearing on the 22nd. And they said, to be honest, we just got, the IS officer said, if it was for me, I would let you go. But we just got some orders to detain anyone who comes to the office. The FBI officer tried to come up with some excuse. So back when I came to the US in 2014, I came on a visitor's visa to study film in Chicago, and it was expected to be for 5-6 months. Then things got too dangerous in Egypt after the security forces in Egypt broke into my house right after I came to the US and, you know, vandalized my house and left a message. They left a letter saying that we'll get you wherever you're at. So my family said, you cannot come back. So I looked for a legal way to stay. And I got an R visa, religious or clergy visa, to work as a youth director in one of the Islamic centers in Chicago. But the visa came too fast. Like, I got it in 12 days, which was very, very weird. And neither the Islamic Center nor myself were ready to start working. We had some discussions over the contract, and we did not agree on things, and I didn't feel comfortable committing to this job without having clear, you know, agreement. and I ended up leaving them and applying for asylum because now that was my last resort. So they took that and said, you got an R visa, but you didn't use it. And this is not actually a crime. Like, I got an R visa, I was eligible for it. And it was clear the Islamic Center sent a letter to the USCIS withdrawing their petition for to sponsor me for an R visa. And I applied for asylum during during the first year of me entering the country, which means everything was going okay. So I think
were you an imam at that time?
I was the director. I'm an imam since before even I came here. It seems like he was trying to find anything to. I said, what was wrong with my R visa? I was granted the R visa based on a petition that proved that I was eligible for it. And after I was granted the visa, these people did not agree with, we did not agree together. So I just left and applied for asylum. What was wrong? I did not, there was no gap. So I think he was just trying to find. He said, yeah, you got an R visa, but you didn't use it. I said, I was legal all the time.
Let's go back to a couple of things you've just mentioned about your time in Egypt. We've read and we've reported that you were working as a journalist in Egypt during the Arab Spring. We'd like to know more about that and that how did that lead to the harm that came your way and your decision to leave Egypt?
So the harm actually started before I was a journalist. So during my time in college, the first time I got detained was in 2000. I was not happy with the corrupt dictatorship in Egypt that ruled Egypt for over 30 years. So as part of student opposition, we protested the government peacefully, of course. So I got detained three times before I was a journalist, three times as an activist, 2000, 2005, and 2010. We had the Egyptian Revolution 2011. That's when I started working as a news producer for international televisions as a journalist. And this was actually the reason I left the U.S. and sought asylum, left Egypt and sought asylum in the U.S. After working as a journalist during the Arab Spring, we had a military coup in July of 2013. And the military came back to take power by force. They kidnapped the elected president, the cabinet, and they were targeting anyone who was opposing them. It was a bloody military coup. Over 15,000 people killed until today. Every protest that I covered or participated in was bloody, and I saw blood in front of my eyes. I saw people killed before my eyes. And I got detained in August 11, a bloody day in the history of Egypt. After the military coup, the people who opposed the coup gathered in a big sit-in where hundreds of thousands of people gathered peacefully protesting the coup and asking them to release the president and uphold the constitution. So I got detained as I was covering one of the protests and sit-in. I was taken to a military base near Cairo where I spent 3 or 4 days. And my crime was simply, you're a traitor, you work for a foreign agency. And I said, okay, I'm a journalist, I'm doing my job, and I actually have credentials. I got a work authorization from the Ministry of Information, press. So what are you talking about? So yeah, you're working for foreign agents, you know, the United States.
So just to clarify, it was a state-operated information agency you worked for.
Yeah.
So that was the foreign agent?
Yeah, okay. If you do not work for the government, if you're not supporting the military coup, so you are the enemy of the country, you are a tool to destabilize the country, you hate what they call the revolution. For them, the military coup was a revolution, although people never participated in it. It was just tanks and armed officers and soldiers. So when I asked, what do you mean by work for agents? Yeah, you guys work for the U.S. Intelligence and Israeli intelligence to destabilize Egypt. This is actually a copy-paste charges to all those throwing people. And I told him, do you have any evidence on that? I work for actually Latin American media. It's not even American media. I said, yeah, your job is to destabilize the country and we can actually take you to a military court. We could kill you and nobody will know what happened. We could forcibly disappear you and nobody will know where you're at. Or we could take you to a military court where the judges will either give you a life sentence or a death sentence. After being there for 3-4 days for no known reasons, it was a big number, and I think they were detaining anyone who was protesting or anyone who could catch in the street. They took us in a big truck and somewhere in an area called Medinet Mas, which is part of New Cairo, and out of a sudden they opened the back door and asked us to leave the truck and kneel down on our knees, and the truck just ran away and we were just free. So I don't really know what happened.
Obviously the truck driver was a sympathizer of sorts.
I was probably working for an agent too.
Yeah.
So arrested 3 times as a student protester, 1 time when you were working as a journalist, and those kind of combined, those influence your decision to seek to leave and to come to the United States.
Yeah, the situation in Egypt was very scary. They would go to arrest someone, and if they found them at home, they would kill them in front of their family because the prisons were filled with people, and they would kill anyone in the street. No accountability. Fortunately, the military coup was backed by the U.S. during the at that time, and was backed by the European Union. So there was no way they will back off. And my family kept pushing me to leave the country because I was wanted for the government. They came to my house twice before I left, and they killed or arrested many journalists. One of my colleagues that we worked together is in life sentence right now in the Egyptian prison. So my family kept pushing me. So for me to come to the U.S., to Chicago to study film for 5-6 months was a way to just get away. I did not really think that I'll be applying for asylum when I came to the U.S. I thought in 5-6 months things were, you know, cool down and I can come back to Egypt. And unfortunately, things got worse. And as I said, a few days after I arrived in the U.S., they broke into my house, vandalized it, and left this message telling me that they will get me wherever I'm at. That's when I decided to stay and apply for asylum.
I think that's helpful to know, because I think when people were following your story, one of the things that was surprising was that you were seeking asylum from Egypt. You know, U.S. tourists can travel to Egypt right now. The United States has fairly good relationship with Egypt. I don't think a lot of people understand the situation for people like you that were going through that coup at the time. Do you think there's ever an opportunity where you could return to Egypt if you wanted to?
Go back? Mm-hmm. That's impossible. I'll get killed right away. Like, during these 12 years since I left, after the military coup in 2013, there are between 100,000 and 150,000 political detainees. None of them was charged with any charge. None of them. They were just arrested, and we have over 15,000 people killed since then. We have an unknown number of people who are were forcibly disappeared. If you just randomly download Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, or even State Department annual report on human rights any year, randomly right now, and look into Egypt, one of the worst in human rights, one of the worst in violations of people's rights. So for me, to go back would be very risky. Mm. And
so safe for U.S. tourists, but not safe for a returning citizen.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Because their problem is with their own citizens. They might actually, for you as a tourist, if you showed any opposition to the government, they might arrest you too. Giulio Regini is an Italian citizen who was getting his PhD in social science and was running some, surveys and studies and was writing some papers on the situation in Egypt. And he started living with the people and, writing on the social conditions and human rights violations. He was kidnapped, got tortured, and then they threw him in a desert area near Cairo. And then when his family, pressured, they showed his body and they said he was kidnapped by some gangsters and he was tortured. And eventually, as some activists showed some evidence and the European Union started pressuring them, they admitted that an officer tortured him and they found lots of injuries and burn. And so this is an Italian European citizen. And they did that once he showed any opposition. Imagine what they will do. And his mom, Giulio's mom, said they killed him like an Egyptian or tortured him like an Egyptian, which means this is very normal to the Egyptians.
Right, right. So you have family still back in Egypt.
Yeah, I still have my family back in Egypt.
Yes. And I think your lawyers have said that you hope that they will come here. Can you tell us a little bit about that process and whether it's realistic?
As an asylee, you have the right to apply for your family to join you here once you are granted asylum. And that's exactly what I did after 2018. Mm-hmm. And for 7 years now, my then wife, unfortunately, things did not work well. My marriage get impacted by these 12 years of me not being able to go back to Egypt, and my wife and son. I have one son who is 16 right now. They couldn't make it to the U.S. Plus, the government started to harass her family. In October of 2024, very, very recent, my wife's nephew, who's a physician, very, very brilliant guy and very successful, he was kidnapped again by the secret police. They call it security. And he was detained for 5-6 months from October till I think they released him in March or April. And the first thing they asked him about was his relationship with me. So in October 2024, after 11 plus years of me leaving Egypt, they're still looking into that. My brother was detained in 2019-2020. I don't really remember when. And he was never an activist. He never did anything. And he was even blaming me for putting myself into this trouble for no reason. And I got detained for 3-4 months. And again, his main crime was he was my brother. So I think they kept targeting me. And when they started targeting and harming my wife's family members, this was actually the last thing that pushed her and her family to work on divorce.
Right, right. Is it possible that your son would come here?
That's what I'm hoping. I think, Frankie knows, and she's working on his application. He already has a pending application for 7 years, which is beyond the normal processing time. People usually take a year or two to be here. It's been 7 years. Never met him. I never seen him for since I left Egypt.
Have you been able to keep in touch with him at all?
Yeah, we talk on social media. I only see mm-hmm. him on screens.
Sure.
And also, if I got my green card, which is something we're working on, I think I'm eligible for it right now, I can automatically apply for his green card, and hopefully within a few months or a year, he will be here.
So just for our listeners' benefit, before we kind of shift gears and talk about your experience at the ICE detention facility, the file the FBI had on you, it turned out that some of the groups you were involved with, they were mistaken in terms of whether or not they were terrorist groups or not. Can you just briefly summarize where the confusion happened and how it got cleared up.
I don't think there was a confusion. I think this was intended. This was...
on behalf of the FBI?
I don't know who made that. I think it was the Department of Homeland Security. Basically, after I was granted asylum in 2018, right after, I started getting stopped at every airport when I'm flying to undergo what they called a random additional screening. It was very unrandom because I was always stopped at every flight, like 20, I counted 21 flights until I stopped the flying at all. I drive 15 hours to Minnesota or Texas and I don't fly because of this harassment. And I sought legal advice and people told me, you know, this is typical for Muslims. People get into some FBI watch lists and leave it without knowing why they were in and why they're out. Eventually, will be out. And then I got denied access to a correctional facility that I was supposed to work as a chaplain in Oregon in 2021. And then they said it was an FBI flag. At the beginning, they said, I think there was a confusion. Your fingerprints were confused with someone else or your name was confused because they cleared me. And after 1 week, they flagged me again. This is when I sought legal representation from the Muslim Legal Fund, Frankie and her team. Then we filed lawsuits against the government, multiple lawsuits against every agency that might be involved. Because basically, you guys are telling me there was something wrong. And when I asked for the information, I didn't get any information. And I got fired from this job because of this flag. So...
Well, and I'm guessing the lawsuits themselves created more flags.
That's exactly what happened. That's why I said it was not confusion. It was intended. Because I was invited to the USCIS office in Chicago, in Cincinnati in 2022 for my green card interview, which means things were going okay. And then they said, we're going to give you a response in a month. And response should be a granted green card because I did everything. They made sure that I filed everything they wanted. I answered all the questions. So an answer means a green card in a month. And I had to wait for 6, 7, 8 months. And then they sent me another invitation for another interview. I don't think it's normal to have someone for 2 interviews for the green card. Most people get their green card without an interview. And many people get 1 interview mostly when it is a marriage-based green card application. But in my case, I met for once and then they asked me to go for the second one. And very similar to the situation that I had in ICE, I found 2 officers, the same officer that had the interview with me, the first interview. I was very friendly in the first time and then not as friendly in the second time. Somebody else was dictating them the questions and they spent 2 hours 3 pages full of questions about everything in my life, very provocative questions about my history, my degrees, my relationship with people, and again, trying to throw things in my mouth that could create any discrepancy of anything that I have applied for before or any information that I have provided before. And it was a tense conversation, and I asked valid questions like, when am I getting my green card? And they were not happy that I asked this question. They basically did not admit my right to ask this question. So I think there was no confusion. I think it was intended. And when they failed to respond to the court and the judge in DC, where I filed for, you know, information, I filed lawsuits against the government to reveal information. You guys are accusing me of being a terrorist. Terrorists do not fight the government to reveal information. I should be scared of the information you have against me. I'm telling you, show them. Tell me what is wrong about me. What do you have against me? I lived here for 11 and a half years. All of my speeches are online and mostly live streamed. Tell me there is something wrong. So I think, back to your point, it was not a confusion, it was intended. So during the interview, and actually when I applied for the R visa, you have to be affiliated with a religious-based organization. And this organization that I was volunteering with, and I was elected as a board member of one of its chapters in Egypt, is the most reputable and respected nonprofit in the Middle East, not only in Egypt, sponsoring over now between 400,000 and 500,000 orphans in Egypt. They've never been designated as a terrorist organization in any country in the world. including Egypt. The Egyptian military coup government confiscated lots of funds and money of 1,200 nonprofits, including this one. But after every nonprofit went to court and challenged that, they were all cleared. And now this organization is the biggest partner of the Egyptian military coup government and their charity work. Then they tried to say that this organization, they couldn't accuse me of being a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, who is designated as a Muslim, as a terrorist organization after the military coup in Egypt, and not in the U.S., only in Egypt and a couple of non-democratic, dictatorship in the Middle East, like UAE and Saudi Arabia, which is mainly politicized. Even the U.S. official said this was a politicized designation. So they couldn't prove that or even couldn't accuse me of being a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. But they said, you are a member of this organization, and this organization collaborated somehow in 2012 when the Muslim Brotherhood was legal and was actually the ruling party, had the president elected from them and had the majority in the parliament. And they collaborated together in 2012. For what? Like manufacturing weapons, for killing people? No. Providing medical aid to the needy people in the suburbs of Egypt. So the collaboration.
So in other words, they had to connect several dots.
Exactly.
To bring,
yeah. And they're unconnectable. Because as I said, none of them was terrorists at the time. And actually the collaboration was on legal things, providing medical aid.
When the FBI interviewed you in July with ICE, was that the focus of the interview?
I think their focus was about everything in my life. That's why I thought they were trying to find anything to take against me in court.
Right.
Everything about my life, when I was a student, my protests, my religious studies, my jobs, my friends, my travels.
But dating back to February, when you first lost asylum, or the interview that led to the loss of asylum, it seems as though most of the questions were about the group.
Exactly.
And I read that transcript, and
yes.
And you just keep being asked and asked and asked about the group. Is it violent? No. Is it active? Is it part of Muslim Brotherhood? No. And so on and so forth. So
I even provided to the USCIS office in Chicago, the office that interviewed me to revoke my asylum and even revoked my asylum. I got them a final court ruling from the highest administrative court in Egypt that ruled that this organization had nothing to do with the Muslim Brotherhood and the government should stop harassing them and just release their funds and their assets. I presented that and I gave a copy to the USCIS office.
But they still believe it's still you lost your asylum. So, and here we are in July. And then it all goes bad again. So why don't we move to that?
Let's do that. I want to also just really briefly, before we get into your time at the Butler County Jail, was the job that you lost in Portland what led you to Cincinnati?
Yes. So when I lost my job, I started looking for other jobs, and I got a job offer to come to move to Cincinnati to work at Cincinnati Children's.
At Cincinnati Children's as a chaplain.
Yes.
And you were there for?
4 years.
4 years.
From okay. July of 2021 till June 2024.
All right. Now.
All right.
Patty.
So, Butler County, at the press conference when you were released, you said some people were very, very good and some people were not good. And so we'd like to hear about your experience in the Butler County Jail. We don't get the chance to talk to many people who are actually released from ICE detention and come in and tell us about it. So if you could just talk about your time, your 72, 73 days there.
It was the most traumatic event I ever had in my life. For someone who has been talking about my detention and torture in Egypt, during my first three detentions, at least in Egypt, I was badly tortured. Severely tortured. And it was 3, 4, 5 days mostly, but it was severe torture in the Egyptian security forces dungeons. But for someone to have experienced this and was in the middle of a massacre in Egypt in 2013, to say that my time at the Butler County Jail was most traumatic in my life, it just tells you how bad it was. I left the ICE facility around 2 p.m., arrived at the Butler County Jail at 3 a.m. on July 9th. And from the first minute, you just get to realize how painful and how awful it will be to be in this place. It's a maximum security jail. Political detainees or just detainees, people who are not indicted with any crime should not be there to begin with. One of the worst places for the ICE detainees, I met people who are detained by ICE in jail who came from other facilities. And what they're talking about compared to the Butler County Jail, this is a terrible place to be. From the first minute, somebody makes you believe that you have to leave your freedom, your dignity, and your humanity at the door. When you enter the Butler County Jail, if you walk in a corridor, it will be just like that, 60, 70 degrees temperature. They held us in a waiting room, whatever they call it, and it's literally a freezer, freezing room. They took my cloth. You're only supposed to have one item, one piece of cloth on your upper body. And it left me with my t-shirt. And it's, I would say, 20, 30 degrees. And I don't know why they do that. 13, 14 people were with me in the room. A toilet at the end of the room, open to everyone. And you're supposed to use this. You're supposed to use the toilet in front of 13, 14 people. Very, very dehumanizing. And when I asked them to let me use a bathroom that was for detainees, people usually use it, they said, no, you have to use this one. And when I said, no, this is no way I can use that. And the officer was mocking me and laughing at me. And they left me for between 4 to 5 hours before someone allowed me to use a bathroom. I arrived at 3 p.m. I went to my cell at 3 a.m., 12 hours in this freezing room. I saw people, it's a dirty room, two rusty metal beds, no blankets, no mattresses, nothing at all. You sleep on the floor, and you, if you look in the room, 13, 14 people, everyone is trying to keep themselves warm. I had to keep running in the cell and do some exercise to keep myself warm, freezing. And after that, you're supposed to do what they call booking, where you become an inmate, take information, and you have to change your cloth. And this was one of the most dehumanizing thing. It just took me back to Egypt when I was dehumanized and tortured. Three of us, two Latin American people and myself, walked into a room to take off our cloth and put on the jail uniform. And the same officer that was mocking me, was laughing at me when I asked to use the bathroom, asked us to strip naked, to take off all of our cloth. And I told him, what do you mean? He said, yeah, you take off all of your cloth and then put on those. I said, I cannot do that in front of other people. This is dehumanizing. And he started laughing and telling me, listen, it seems like you'll have a long, rough time here. Forget about your life outside. You have to abide by the regulations. I said, what type of regulations, what type of laws that will force someone to strip naked in front of others? This is dehumanizing. We are not in concentration camps, or are we? And then he said, I know you will tell me I am traumatized because they kidnapped me from the street. I don't care. I left my kids alone at home. I don't care. I haven't eaten anything the whole day. I don't care. I haven't slept. I'm tired. I don't care. You just have to listen to the commands. And I told him, there is no way I'll strip naked in front of anyone. There is a screen wall in this same room, which is very easy to ask us to go behind this screen wall, yes. Go behind this wall and just take off all your clothes and put on the jail uniform. And he said, no, you cannot do that. You have to strip naked and I have to look at you and these people have to look at you. And I said, there is no way I can do that. Go do whatever you want. That is not happening. And I started raising my voice. And then he finally accepted that I go behind the screen wall and take off my cloth. And then he was very angry at me. They moved me at 3 a.m., deadly tired, deadly freezing, to my cell. I never been to jail in the U.S. I never been to jail in Egypt except for this unlawful detention and torture in the dungeons of the security forces, not even jail. So I don't know any rules. My first few hours, of course, they give us some cloth and uniform, and I had no idea what is happening. Nobody ever taught me in this jail or in any other jail. Nobody taught me, you know, the laws, the regulations, what is expected. So the officer that was taking care of the pod during that shift, I wanted to ask them if they have a towel. I need to wash and I need a towel. And there is a yellow line. They're having their office at the entrance of the pod near the door. And there are some flight of steps. Then there is a yellow line that you're not supposed to cross because you might represent a threat to these people. And I didn't have no idea. I didn't even sleep. I slept for 2 hours. They woke me up at 5 a.m. And I can't even see. And I just went there and said, hey, sir, can I get a towel? And I probably stepped over this line. And he had a pistol and ran after me and telling me, listen, you have to follow the rules or I'll beat you. And he used the F word. And I felt like this can't be real. You know, this is not how people are supposed to be treated. During this time, for the 73 days, we were locked inside our cells. We literally were in a box, inside a bigger box, literally box. No access to light, no access to any court. It's just a box. 19 hours a day in our cells. 19 hours a day. We're only out for 4 hours, 45 minutes. So 19 hours, 15 minutes locked inside our cell. And sometimes it is more than that. Sometimes you go out for your break time or they call it recreation time. And if two people had an argument in any other cell, I'm sorry, in any other pod in the jail, every other pod should be locked down. So I should be locked down in my cell 15 minutes after we start our recreation time, having a conversation with my attorney or my family or eating something, then lock down, go back to your cell. What is happening? Something is happening in another pod. 19 hours a day, which is supposed to be only apply to the maximum security detainees. I had an argument with one of the officers one day asking for a quiet space for me and the other Muslim inmates to pray. It's an obligation on Muslims. We have it 5 times a day, but it's impossible to do it 5 times because we are locked for 19 hours. So whenever we are out for recreation time, we did not ask for any exception. Just give us some quiet space to pray. And there is a room that we can use. And it is used by the Christian volunteers who come to lead service and for a Muslim volunteer who come to lead a service once a week. So we can use it once or twice a day. Depends on the time we are out. And we had an argument. He refused and I asked him if he can ask. He said, I don't have an answer. I asked him if he knew someone who has an answer. He refused. We have an argument and it's on camera. Then he lied to his supervisor and told him I was objecting a lockdown. I got handcuffed, taken to this freezing room again for an hour or so. Then they conducted a hearing where the sergeant who conducted the hearing to decide if I was at fault told me that his evidence were the testimony of that officer. I said, his testimony cannot be an evidence against me because basically it's a word versus word. The second is their video. I said, okay, show me what in the video told you that I objected. Did he, for example, ask me to go to my cell? And I said, no, it was just face-to-face conversation. He even touched me, and he was not supposed to do that. Then they decided to put me in solitary confinement for 20 days. And although they promised me that this will not impact my right to access to my attorney, to have regular visits on the weekend, and to commissary food, I was deprived from all three. I kept protesting. I was only allowed out of my cell 1 hour a day, from midnight to 1 a.m., where nobody is out. I can't talk to a family after midnight. I can't talk to my attorney after midnight. I can't talk to friends after midnight. And I did not have access to commissary food. I had to eat the terrible jail food. And I kept protesting and kept asking. And my attorneys were outside working. And I also met with an ICE officer that they sent them a report. And he was really understanding. And he said, based on what they wrote, I don't think you should be here. You shouldn't be in solitary. And unfortunately, they had to lock me down with another gentleman who was suffering from severe mental issues. He knew that. He told me they did not give me my mental, my medication. He was awake the whole night, making noise, reading very out loud, flushing the toilet, walking back and forth, and it was impossible for me to sleep even for 1 hour. They ended up getting me out of this solitary confinement after I kept protesting and kept sending grievance. They realized that it was not actually founded. It was not real. So
that ended up being how many days?
6 days.
6 days.
Yes.
It was supposed to be 20?
20 days, yes.
But
6 days.
But you were able to be released in six.
You asked me about my experience and said it was bad and some were good. Yes, I'll also have to be objective and say that some officers were very kind. Some were very respectful. And some of them would come to me and tell me, we're praying for you. We're following your story. My family asked me to come and tell you that they're praying for you. Yes, there were some exceptions. Mm-hmm. I can't say that what was happening in jail with me, I mean, this particular instance, I can't say it was systematic, just to be objective, but it was a violation and they were okay with it. And actually, the sheriff, when he was asked about this by some TV channels, he kept repeating the same story that they were told, that his officer told him. He said I was argumentative. He said, I told an officer, do you not know who I am? And I never use this language. I'm a very disrespectful person. And I told the guy that came, the surgeon that came to conduct a hearing, I told him, how about that? Don't listen to me at all. Don't listen to that officer. How about you go to every other officer? I was in three different pods. How about you ask every other officer, if any of them could remember any negative experience with me? I'm respectful to everyone. I thank them for things that they have to do. When they do their job, I thank them for it. And I praise them for it. And also this officer ended up being in court because three Muslim inmates before me, and of course I knew that when my legal team Googled him, he was in court for three different charges, lawsuits filed by three different Muslims because of his abuse and discrimination. And that actually was not enough. When I told the surgeon that conducted the hearing, what if I told you that this officer had three lawsuits filed against him because of discrimination and harassment in this very jail. And I said, well, I'll look into that, but you'll still be in solitary.
Are you bitter after this experience?
Bitter compared to how I was before?
Yes.
Of course not. And I don't think I'll be the same for too long. This experience left scars and wounds that I don't expect to get rid of anytime soon. I said at the beginning of answering this question, I'm really, really sad to say that my experience at the Butler County Jail was more terrible, more traumatizing and more painful, more dehumanizing than my experience when I was tortured in Egypt. Yes, I was tortured there. I was physically tortured. I was not physically tortured here. But after 11 and a half years in this country, legal in every minute of it, documented in every minute of it, to be treated this way and to feel at some time somebody could actually fabricate charges, and you could, your rights could be violated, and you could be punished because you believed that you have constitutional rights to sue the government, is beyond the traumatizing. And every single day, I felt like this place was my transitional place before I get sent back to Egypt and get killed. So, of course, I'm not bitter. I don't think I'll ever be the same.
A couple of questions as we run out of time here. It's been a little shy of a month since you have been, let's see.
About the 19th, yeah.
And I just, how are you spending your time and what's ahead for you? What's on the horizon for you right now?
As I said, I try to enjoy the things that I was deprived of, that I didn't realize how precious they were. I try to spend time in the sun and nature. For me, this is heaven. I would give someone $1,000 if they give me 1 hour, in a sunny spot at the Butler County Jail. And I'm really serious about this. So I spend time outside. I see my friends that I thought I will never see them again. I definitely focus on my spirituality because this is a very important part of my life, and it's a big part of my support system. I try to advocate for those that I left behind because I promised them that I'll speak for them. And since I'm here, I'd like to repeat that. They lied to us and said detaining and deporting the worst of the worst, the criminals, and I never seen that. The sheriff said they have between 400 and 500 IS detainees. I think some other reports said there were 1,100, I'm not sure, but regardless, I moved between three pods, which means I interacted, I was close to 150 people in the three pods. And I could say, I said, I met some of the best people I met in my life. They're innocent people. None of them committed a crime. Of all the people I talked to, two people told me they were, they committed a crime. One of them said he killed a person, but he finished his imprisonment and now he's getting detained. The other one, he was driving under influence. Away from those, everybody was documented. Everybody came here legal through the southern border. They were promised asylum. They were in court. And out of a sudden, everything got revoked and they're going home. These are not criminals. They're good people and they have, stories that they told me. And some of them spent 28 years in this country, having two of his children serving in the military and now getting deported to a country that he doesn't know anyone at.
How are you supporting yourself? What's on the horizon in terms of a job?
I'm starting to see a therapist to help me with this. I gave myself a month or two before I started thinking of a job or looking for a job. And I try to be around my friends who know me well and know the experience I had, so they can support me. Mm-hmm.
In the end, what do you make of your case here in the United States, that you were arrested, that you were held, and that you were released? We've heard from attorneys that that just does not happen very much, that DHS changes course. What do you make of that?
As I said at the very beginning, this was very unexpected. We're looking at many scenarios, but then God has a different scenario. As a religious person, I believe that this was close to a miracle, if not a miracle, because we really exhausted all the means, but these people never cared about anything of what we have done. But if there's something I would like to highlight here is the importance of advocacy and raising our voices. Yes, it's all in God's hand, but legally we did everything, and these people never listened. We challenged their accusations in February at the asylum office in Chicago in court. They didn't listen. They never listened. I think when people raised their voice, when people protested and petitioned and talked to the media, I think this was very important, and the government started to realized that this is not a normal case. I think I would have been just one of the cases that will be hidden in their paperwork if the people in my city, Cincinnati, and Northern Kentucky stood up and started raising their voice and advocating for me.
Were you aware of that support while you were detained?
Yeah, and it was one of the greatest forms of support. We had small televisions in our cells, so I would run to the TV every time there is, you know, there are some news, which happened a lot. And also these other inmates would always, you know, call my name. Hey, you're on the TV. Just go look and see what your friends are doing. So I was aware, and it really brought a lot of comfort at some difficult time.
Well, Ayman Solomon, I want to thank you for spending the time with us today. I think it's important that you share your story for people to understand, in your own words, what you experienced. And also, if I may say, I'm sure it took some bravery, because after your experience, many people would want to just keep a low profile and not have that attention on them and just try to quietly put their life back together. So the fact that you spent time with us today, reliving a little bit of that hardship you went through, we can't thank you enough. So thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. And I also like to thank you for, unfortunately, I didn't have access to anything that was published in the Inquirer while I was in jail. They are not allowing any articles or newspapers inside, but I read everything that was written about me. So I really thank you very much. You were part of these efforts to shed some light on my story. And I'm sure it was part of the pressure that led to my release. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, Patty, that was certainly a departure from our usual lighthearted guests and topics. That was a heavy listen, I would say.
He have lived through some pretty dramatic events and trauma. And he was brave to come and tell us a story, and also that he's seeing a therapist. I think that's great for him, and very kind of him to share it with our listeners.
I think it's hard to hear somebody say that their experience in a Butler County jail was worse than being physically tortured in Egypt.
It's pretty dramatic. So not physically tortured, but mentally, emotionally, psychologically, clearly traumatized.
And for 72 days, thinking that this was just delaying the inevitable, and that's returning to Egypt, where he is certain he would be picked up and killed.
Right. His lawyer said that all along, that that was his fear. And hearing him say it is a whole different thing, because obviously it was very real to him.
Well, with that, I think we should wrap things up. I want to thank everybody for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of the Enquirer and Cincinnati.com.
And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating, share it with a friend who loves all things Cincinnati.
And finally, if you value local journalism and haven't subscribed for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now is a great time. Just go to Cincinnati.com and click on the subscribe button to see a special offer for new subscribers.
Thanks again, and join us next week.